Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Michael Reed Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Wednesday morning, the 17th of April. Good morning. With much debate and discussion from now till 11 a.m, this is Michael Reed on LMFM. Social media is all the rage. Young or old, who isn't checking their status, updating their Insta, or going viral by dropping a note in 280 words or less?
We all will agree that social media is an absolute cesspit. X is the worst. And to be put it very plainly, X is the worst. And, you know, in my experience, social media is not always a nice and comfortable place. We're all, being presumptuous, but I think we're all in the era that grew up with disposable cameras and Nokia phones. So we'll be grateful for that, because we didn't have to put up with. Ever with so much coming at us.
And that is because we've discovered that social media is proving to be dangerous, and especially so for young people.
There isn't a safe way to lie in the middle of a road. Ask a child to lie in the middle of a road. You know, we could give them guidance. We could tell them to wear bright colours. You know, go off peak. You know, put a light on them. And it really, social media is not a safe place. We can give them guidance. We can tell them to do, you know, this and that. But it's not a safe place for a child.
That's Fianna Fáil Senator Erin McGreehan speaking yesterday at a meeting of the Committee on Children, which was attended by the social media giants X, TikTok and Meta.
In the first instance, we have legal obligations. In Ireland, there is both criminal and civil sanctions that apply to companies like ours.
That's ultimately what we have to keep doing, is listening to young people and taking on board their advice, working with experts, taking on board that, developing resources that help people on the platform if they are struggling or having a difficult time. It can be a place where they actually find help, and we believe we have a great responsibility in that sense. We've developed a lot of wellbeing resources around suicide, self-harm, that we've developed with the Samaritans and other expert organisations, so that actually it could be a place where people can find community and safety, and that's something we put a lot of effort and resource into.
We have our legal obligations in Ireland, we have our legal obligations in Europe, we have a number of regulators now who are looking at the measures we have in place and whether they are sufficient. I think it's going to be an ongoing an evolving space.
It requires content moderation as well as technology. You need to be on it, you need trained content moderators who understand this issue. We actually have two experts, global experts, in suicide and self-harm sort of on our payroll as well. So suicide, self-harm, eating disorders, that is a sort of dedicated part of our safety team. And that's really important. Those people have come here from clinical psychology and wellbeing environments to advise us, and they manage the expert group.
Let's hear from Fianna Fáil Senator Erin McGreehan, who we did hear from earlier in those clips, but joins us now on the phone. And a very good morning to you, Senator McGreehan. Thanks for your time with us. We heard some of the responses from the social media companies to you there yesterday. Did they win you over?
Absolutely not, Michael. It was an interesting meeting yesterday, but quite frankly, for me, it was absolutely deflating. As a mother, as an aunt of a lot of young people, as a friend of young people, I just find that, you know, there was a lot of nice talk, a lot of, you know, fancy things. We're doing this, we're doing that, we're taking a certain amount of people off online, we're checking content. And the gentleman from Facebook there, or Meta, is it two experts in suicide and self-harm? Two experts. And I think, you know, there they have just two. And that they've put on the payroll as if that's going to, you know, persuade me that they're working actively and consistently in relation to, you know, looking after particularly young people, but all people and all their users. And I think yesterday what came for me was that we have such a long way to go. There is an absolute urgency on this issue. And I felt deflated on it, to be honest, Michael.
Okay. Yeah.
And you know, the young people are very tech savvy. We all know that, but they're not savvy in the ways of the world. There is so much to growing up, so many wonderful things and so many difficult things. And social media access has been so dangerous and harmful to so many things. And yes, there is enjoyable parts of social media, but there is enjoyable parts to lots of different things. But when on the overall scheme, when you balance it all up, it's more harmful. And I think...
Whose fault is that? Because we heard each of the companies there talk about the legal obligations that they have to live up to.
Yes, I think, we all have a collective responsibility, Michael. Absolutely. That is taken for granted. Yes, legislators and governments and the EU have a huge responsibility. And also, when you provide a product, there is a huge responsibility on their hands. And yes, there is a legislative responsibility. There is. They have legal responsibilities. And it just makes me, you know, think, are the legal responsibilities enough? Are they robust enough? We have Commissioner Nimon in the country. It's newly set up, but we're still waiting on the code of conduct, or the online code of conduct for that. And yes, you can say an online code that's, you know, it's quite soft. Legislative, you know, things to do needs to have a code that can change, because as we know, every single day there are technological advances, changes. So we do need to have a code to be able to, you know, keep up with that. But I think we need to have that code, you know, acted on and published, and we need social media companies to really listen and to really, you know, to really act on looking after their customers. You know, they have a responsibility. You know, car manufacturers have a responsibility to keep people safe when in the cars, or to you know, to work to make. And we know cars are becoming safer. However, they're not. To me, they're not doing enough. They have a responsibility, and I think, you know, we're seeing for the first time over the past, you know, 5-6 years, there is a huge level and severe levels of mental health issues among young people and older people, of course.
And do you attribute that to social media, though?
Absolutely. In fact, and research does attribute it to social media, and that strive for, you know, the instant gratification, the perfection. And we all put our good sides out, Michael, when we're in public. We all definitely put our good sides out when we're on social media. I try to, and I think I'm sure all of us do. And now I think it's not about screen time and media regulation. It's actually a public health issue. And we'd have seen, you know, Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin at the weekend, at Fianna Fáil Ardette at the weekend, speaking about how this is a public health issue. It's of our generation. And I think now that maybe that we're actually looking at it from a public health point of view, that it's damaging our children's minds, it's damaging their development, and social media is dangerous. It's not just about, you know, screen time is bad, and you know, you might, you know, but it's actually changing a child's brain in how they function in the world.
Bringing the child into a world that maybe they would never have entered into had it not been for social media. And I think the primetime programme on television gave us a good insight into that, where years ago children might have been out skipping or playing football, but today they're on their phone and learning about self-harm and suicide. I think most people who don't use TikTok, who watched Primetime last night, would have been appalled by what they saw. But this isn't news, is it, really?
I think the extent of it and the how you can just instantly go into that rabbit hole of what RTE Primetime report saw last night. And it was so upsetting to watch that programme last night. And we see in the Irish Times this morning about another group of researchers in Dublin City University talking about young men going on to onto TikTok. And it says bombarded with misogynist content on social media, amplifying anti-feminist and other extremist content straight away into that. And we know, Michael, that young people are having a tough. We know that a young person questions everything about themselves, about the world. That's what's good about young people. They question, they're open-minded. But if we're initially putting them on TikTok into a device that is a time bomb and bringing them down into a world that is so toxic, so dangerous, and they're not equipped to deal with it.
Yeah, and that
is the problem.
That article that you refer to on that research from Dublin City University in the Irish Times today says that young men are being fed masculinist, anti-feminist and other extremist content, but as you said, but irrespective of whether they sought out general or male supremacist related content or not.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that is frightening. It made me ill. I'm a mom of four young boys, and it made me sick to think that if they had a TikTok account, this is where they're bringing them to straight away. And curious minds are curious. Young people go and search. They go for search for extremities. Nothing wrong with them, but that's just the mind of a child, of a curious child. And I think, you know, we have, you know, various issues, Michael, in relation to the age verification. We have issues in relation to verification of an individual and whether people can be anonymous online.
Yeah.
There is a discussion about the illegal content, and all of us agree that illegal content is, you know, should be gone. But harmful content is something where the moderators are not looking at the minute, in my opinion, enough. Clearly, the research is showing that. So harmful content, and harmful content, I think, is where human moderators come in, because nobody, I think, in their right minds would think that you know, Andrew Tate is a good role model for young men or young women. And I think that is where we're really, really falling down on. And yes, it is legislators' responsibility. It is our newly formed Commission of the Man's responsibility. And it also is parents' responsibility to restrict the social media, because we do not want, we want to save the minds of our young people. And that seems a little bit, you know, a little bit maybe, you know, a bit silly to say that, but we genuinely have to save the minds of our young people. I am seeing it across my desk. You're seeing it on your, in so many different ways. We're waiting lists for CAMHS. That's not by accident. You know, children are not just all of a sudden getting such mental health and problems and anxiety problems just because of the time we're living in.
Who is Andrew Tate, and why do you think he's not a good role model?
He's, oh gosh, have you got, I suppose he's to me, he's a disgusting man.
I don't know who he is. So explain to us who he is.
So Andrew Tate has been, you know, has really went over social media in relation to how to treat women. It's very much anti-women. His ideas on teaching young men and on what sexual norms are, pornography norms, and it's very hard to describe, I suppose, Michael, but it's such misogynist language, and teaching young men basically to disrespect women, to think that they are belonging of them, how to treat them. The old saying of treat them mean and keep them keen, but treat them, that's what? And treat them really, really mean.
Really?
Treat them absolutely horrendously in relation to sexual assaults that,
right.
You know, a woman would you know, glorifying rape, glorifying pornography,
right.
And walking young men into a world. And yes, he has big fancy cars. He has a really glamorous life, beautiful women hanging off him.
Okay. So is
and
this...
all on the front of it says, but it's really abusive, abusing women.
Sure.
Women are a belonging and not their own person.
So is this sex education for a lot of boys in this country now?
Quite often. Yes, quite often.
Mm.
Yep. And that brings us into a whole different area of online porn and the access to porn. And I've been working with my colleague Minister Anne Rabbit on this, and because she brought forward was working on a bill in the previous Dáil in relation to how we ban under 18s from online porn. And it's Michael, the online world is not just the what we kind of over the past 15 years or so, you know, that Facebook messaging, keeping in contact with people and family and friends and our friends, our school friends, children, and seeing how they're getting on. It is a dark place for so many reasons. And I think that I'm glad that Micheál Martin has really described it now as public health. And it's not just about the, you know, screen time. It's not just about media regulation.
It took his time, though, didn't he?
I, to be honest, I think so. I think our governments have taken their time. As a mother, as someone who is very much panicky about this, I see the urgency about this, and I hope that urgency and the big talk at the weekend about this public health issue. And we saw Minister Stephen Donnelly on primetime last night speaking about the importance of this. I hope
He didn't really seem to have much of a grasp on it, though, did he?
Well, I don't know if anyone can have a full grasp on this.
I didn't hear him say anything that's going to affect any change, positive change.
Well, I suppose he, as a Minister for Health, was speaking about it in the public health...
On behalf of the government, yeah. I haven't heard anything that will affect positive change. I mean, I'm not disputing anything you say. I don't think anybody is. I think everything you say is... more or less correct and very, very concerning. But it's acceptable because we just let it happen. And maybe when TV3 or Virgin Media or whoever does a programme on it at some time in the future, or your committee has these social media companies in front of them, we'll be talking about it again. But we will be talking about it again in the same context that it's terrible and we shouldn't let it happen, but we're letting it happen. In other words, it's acceptable.
And Michael, that is something that I absolutely fear. And just because I'm part of the government doesn't mean I don't always criticise the government. And I will be doing my damnedest and supporting my colleagues who want to move on this. We saw, during the year, Minister Norma Foley trying to ban smartphones and getting backlash on that as well. So I think we're the adults. We're all the adults here. It's time we adult, to use an American phrase. It's time we stand up and actually do it, because I'm worried. I do not want young children going into this world. I fear when I see young people online, 13-year-olds and over. Imagine sending a 13-year-old down a dark alleyway. We wouldn't do it, Michael.
Yeah.
But this is what we're doing with smartphones and on social media. And you know, it's like, oh, sure, it's a bit of crack. It's no harm.
Mm.
It's no harm until it is harm. Until your child is in a room and feeling upset about something that someone says at school. Feeling vulnerable about how their body is, feeling vulnerable about maybe a death in the family, and going down to and looking at something that glamorizes self-harm, references suicide. And Michael, you know, we all go through really tough times as children. And, you know, as a child, I'm just bringing my own personal experience, being a young girl with someone who lost someone very close to them as a young child. It's a very lonely place. And I fear if I had to have TikTok and looked at that, But as a 13-year-old girl, what type of young girl I would have been at 14 if I had to have been able to have to be exposed to something that educated me on how best to self-harm, how best to commit suicide. That frightens me, Michael. Okay. And we're opening the doors to so many young people, and every young person is vulnerable to this.
And we should all be aware of that. We can regulate and legislate all we want, but undoubtedly there will continue to be loopholes. We all have personal responsibility, like a lot of things in life. And I hope parents listening to us this morning know that they have a responsibility, a duty of care to their children, and that they should
absolutely
be aware,
Michael,
of these pitfalls and rabbit holes that children go down, as you put it. But we have to leave it there for the moment. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us on the programme this morning. Fianna Fáil Senator Erin McGreehan, 0419832000 is our phone number. Text or WhatsApp 086 1800 658. Email michael@lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Well, you may be interested, following our last item, to hear that half of people in this country aged between 18 and 29 say they've low mental well-being. This is according to a report that has been published by the National Youth Council of Ireland called State of Our Young Nation, a report into the lives of Irish 18 to 29-year-olds. And it follows on from research conducted on its behalf by Ipsos Behaviour and Attitudes, which has found that 67% of young people say that housing is the most pressing issue in their lives. 62% say it's the cost of living. Let's speak to Paul Gordon, who's the Director of Policy and Advocacy with the National Youth Council. A very good morning to you, Paul. Thanks indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Tell us a little bit more about your report. Is this a good country for 18 to 29-year-olds to live in these days?
Good morning, Michael. Thanks very much for having me. So, yes, our report launched yesterday kind of mapped out the lives of 18 to 29-year-olds, and there were some worrying findings. I suppose it's a mixed picture in terms of whether it's a good country for young people to live. As you touched on, half of young people showed low mental well-being, and one in three said that they rarely or never feel optimistic about the future. And I suppose when we spoke to young people, many put that down to their current housing situation. Almost half had this dissatisfaction with their current accommodation. More than half were living with their parents. And of those renting, they had seen 15% increases in the past year. So that was really concerning. And I do think it gave a real sense of young people being held back. There were other issues at play, such as the cost of living, but there were also a number of positives they found about life in Ireland.
I'm sure there are. But there is reason for concern, as you say. And you've made a number of recommendations. I think some of those recommendations have been made previously by yourselves and many others, for that matter.
Indeed. And I suppose what we're calling for now is a real focus on the back of this report, because there are a number of very worrying findings. What I would say in the past is there probably has been a lack of ambition when it comes to policies relating to young people, and a lack of coordination. So what we're calling for is for the current government to put in place a cabinet committee on young people that sets new targets, that sets new ambitious targets for the remainder of this government, and that would act as a real sign to young people that they are taking these issues seriously. Because what we are seeing is that young people are really holding back on their aspirations. So traditional milestones in life, like marriage, home ownership and having children, are being pushed out. There are many young people who really feel that they're working hard and doing everything right, but it isn't paying off for them.
All right. One of your recommendations is to address gender inequality. Not the first time we've heard a recommendation of that sort, Paul, but you've discovered that life for young women in this country is worse than it is for young men. They report worse mental and financial well-being, lower satisfaction with paying conditions, and they're coping worse with the cost of living. But what I thought was most surprising is that they say they're more likely to feel they are worse off than their parents' generation. Why is that the case? I mean, we're in a very wealthy country with lots of opportunities, are we not?
Well, we are, and that is something that was reflected in the report. So, you know, a lot of young people did reflect on very positive experiences with education, particularly at second level and third level. And I think there is a kind of a sense that they are grateful for those educational opportunities, greater employment opportunities. But I think what is clear is that many do feel worse off financially than their parents and feel their aspirations are being put on hold because, as we know, in recent years, home ownership among young people has effectively fallen off a cliff. Of those that do own, this report shows they're more likely to have support from their parents than in the past. We have one of the biggest gaps in home ownership between people under 40 and over 40 in Europe. Real wages have fallen, and even those renting are facing quite high increases, but there are also very few people renting. And this is probably a standard rite of passage for many young people that they're not having, and that level of independence, I think, is leading to a generation that, in many senses, is experiencing a form of arrested development.
Right. Okay. Which is a very serious thing to say, but not necessarily the case, because there are opportunities for young people. If they're not available to them in this country, perhaps they are available to them elsewhere. 24,000 people left this country last year to go to Australia alone. Most of them would have been young people. Most young people living in this country today will tell you that they're watching their friends living the life, living the dream in Australia on TikTok or elsewhere.
Yes, well, we are having a steady increase in immigration in recent years. It is a big concern that many young people feel pushed rather than feeling a pull factor to other countries that we might have seen in the past. And what our report shows is that traditionally people might think of young people emigrating as being kind of in their early 20s or just out of college and want to maybe experience a little bit of life abroad. But throughout our report, the young people who had considered emigrating in the past year, it was pretty stable across the ages from 18 to 29. So young people at the in their late 20s are as likely to consider emigrating as those in their early 20s. So that is a real cause for concern, particularly when young people do see other opportunities, particularly relating to housing. Maybe not they're not naive about costs elsewhere, but they generally speaking to friends, I think they do find that there is better quality and better availability elsewhere.
And for those who do go abroad, I take the hope is that they'll come back quite possibly with a deposit for a house.
I think increasingly we are seeing that among young people who often go to either English-speaking countries or maybe some who do go to the Middle East, which is increasingly popular, and people often may save that money and come back and have a deposit for a house, and that's I suppose very positive for them. But there are many others who decide that they simply can't afford to come back here when they do see the price of housing and for many young people, low wages is an issue that was called out in the report as well. So there are big challenges in drawing young people home as well. But many of the positive issues highlighted in the report, particularly kind of really related to young people's connection to Irish culture. They're very proud of Ireland's, I suppose, thriving cultural music, arts scene, and a real connection, particularly in rural areas, but not limited to rural areas, a connection to community. And that really is one of the draws for young people in either staying home or coming home. And that's something that they take great pride in. And it's something we also have to foster by investing in local community facilities and youth work facilities to ensure that there are those outlets for young people, which they do take great pride in and which do provide a really great social outlet.
It's very interesting, isn't it, that the younger half of this cohort aged between 18 to 29, that younger half aged between 18 to 22 believe that they'll be able to buy a house when they're around 30. But when you speak to the older half, those who are between 27 and 29, they believe they'll be more like 37 before they'll be able to buy a house.
Yeah, so it seems that optimism, I suppose, wanes a little bit as these young people age, and that is probably related to their own experiences with life. There's probably a greater degree of optimism at a younger age, and what we are seeing is that young people aged in their late 20s, so 27 to 29, they believe they won't own a home until 37, which is close enough to reality. The Banking and Payments Federation published data last year that said it, the first-time buyers' mortgages are usually in around 35 years old. They seem close enough to being on the money in their predictions there, which is a worry because home ownership is being pushed out further and further. We do have a big divide, I think, between young people and older people in terms of home ownership, and that can cause real concerns in terms of social cohesion. And really for young people, many feel that in the past, if you worked hard and I suppose played by the rules, you would have had the opportunity to own your own home or to have a stable accommodation. And that's really I suppose a basic principle of the social contract with the state, but for many young people it feels like it's broken.
Okay, not for some though, because 13% of this group of around 750 people who participated in your study are house owners, are they?
Yeah, that is the case, and I think what we certainly heard from those young people is that many of them feel very fortunate because they know that many of their friends and colleagues aren't in the same position, and I think increasingly what we are seeing is that young people, this is probably creating more and more pressure on parents as well, because we saw the 54% of those who do own their own home had support from parents, and that I think looking back on figures from the past, it would have shown an increase in, I suppose, the level of support that young people are being offered, which is a positive thing, I suppose, from their parents and to have that opportunity, but many don't really have that opportunity as well. So it is creating a bit of a pressure on parents, but it's also ensuring that some young people who don't have that support are finding it harder to get into the housing market.
And for those who are most pessimistic, amongst the people who you did survey, Paul, do they feel hopeless, or do they feel that they have some power in bringing about change in their lives or in the next generation's lives?
It's a hard question to answer, Michael, but I do think there really was a sense
Well, will it impact on
I
how
think
they vote?
frustration.
Will it impact on how they vote?
Yes, you know, I think there was a real sense of frustration, and I do think young people hopefully are probably, this report resonates with them and it gives them an opportunity to consider the issues that are really affecting them and to make themselves heard, I suppose, not only in the locals and the Europeans this year, but also in the general next year. And I suppose one of the challenges for young people traditionally is that there are lower voting rates, but I think that will change somewhat with reforms of how you vote in terms of registering online, which will make things quite a bit easier. But it's also, I suppose, about political parties meeting young people where they are and responding to the issues in this report so that young people have an opportunity and they can see parties really responding to the issues that matter to them. And I do think a lot of young people are very much exercised by the issues affecting them at the moment, and we'd certainly be encouraging them to use their agency because they do have power in society, and if they don't vote, someone else will be voting on their behalf.
Very good. Paul, thank you indeed for joining us today. Paul Gordon, Director of Policy and Advocacy with the National Youth Council of Ireland.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Some of the messages coming to us this morning. A text from a listener who says, Michael, I'd highly encourage you to do some research on Andrew Tate, especially with the rise of social media and its effects as a whole. As was put to you, Tate's effects go worldwide and make a global impact on the life of young men who are currently being given advice in bad faith by a man who should be and is currently in trouble with the law. Thanks indeed for that. Another text from somebody who says Andrew Tate doesn't teach young men on how to treat women. A ridiculous statement. Well, I don't know much about Andrew Tate, but I think any of these influencers are exactly that, influencers. And that, like any of the stars that we grew up with and aspired to be like influencers don't just give young people a person to emulate. They give them the handbook and they teach them about how to become whatever it is that they're preaching. I think that there's probably some truth. I disagree with the caller. I think it probably was an accurate statement, although, as I said, I don't know much, if anything at all, about this man. Anyway, somebody else says, if you watch Raised by the Village on RTA, it's a good example of how phones and social media are negatively affecting young people. Sean in Dublin 9 has been in touch and he says, in the past, religious orders were the social media of the day, and they brainwashed people with fire and brimstone if we didn't comply. What's the difference? Sean wants to know. Thanks, Sean. It's a very good point, I think. Betty says, Michael, the kids now always have to feel hard done by. Even in a family of two children, one or the other says they're not being treated equally. They can't have a laugh at themselves and they're always envious of their friends, so they'll never be happy. Tom says, Michael, you and Senator Aaron McGrain were talking about 13-year-olds going down rabbit holes. Are you both naive? It's not 13-year-olds. It's 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, and the parents are 100% to blame, says Tom. Thanks for your message, Tom. As well, I think what Aaron McGrain was saying was that you have to be 13 to get onto these sites. We saw on Primetime last night how a reporter posed as a 13-year-old and how, as Aaron McGrain was pointing out, there is no real age verification. So a 6-year-old can pose to be a 13-year-old or so on. So I don't think there's any disagreement. Maybe there was some confusion there, Tom. But thanks for your message. You make a very valid point, as does Maura and Patrick. This is Mr. and Mrs. McGuinness, who had taken the time to write to me by email telling me that they attended the Louth Minor game on Saturday in Kildare. My husband and I go to all of the Louth games, home and away, and for this one we made the journey to Dunlear. We're both in our 70s and have been travelling to Louth games for 50 years. When we went to pay at the gate in Hawkfield, we were told by the official that they wouldn't accept cash. We told them we'd been at the previous minor games and cash was accepted, no problem. He responded that we would need to buy tickets on our phone. But as we don't have smartphones, this wasn't an option for us. We explained this and asked, was cash not legal tender? But he told us to get away if we were not paying by phone and refused to let us in. Is this now the policy of the GAA to send away people who are willing to pay in to see a game, who have travelled to support their team? As I say, that's an email that comes to us from Maura and Patrick McGuinness. I have a feeling that some people will identify with what you're saying, and many thanks for taking the time to email your complaint to us. If you'd like to make a comment, by the way, and you haven't as yet on the programme today, we've plenty of time for your say if you do want to make a comment. 0419832000 is our telephone number. That's 0419832000. You can also text or WhatsApp a message to us. The number is the same for both, 086 1800 658. That's for text or WhatsApp, 086 1800 658, or email michael at lmfm.ie.
Michael Reed on LMFM.
Well, we'd had a lot of discussion in the first hour about young people and how there's reason to be concerned about some of the challenges that young people face in the world today, whether it's to do with the cost of living, aspiring to own a house, or going down rabbit holes on social media. It can be tough. We heard that half of 18 to 22-year-olds say that they have low self-esteem. If you're a parent listening to us this morning and you're kind of at your wit's end thinking, well, what can I do? I'm really out of my depth in terms of all of this. I think you might be interested in joining a webinar in about an hour's time, beginning at 11 o'clock. It's to support parents to support their children's mental health and well-being. Let's speak to Paul Gilligan, who's the CEO of St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, which is organising this in conjunction with the National Parents Council. And a very good morning to you, Paul, and thank you indeed for joining us.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. This starts, as I say, at 11 o'clock. We'll tell people how to log on in a moment. But if people are interested, what can they expect over the course of an hour, I think, this webinar will run for?
Yeah, we're seeking to really empower parents by outlining to them how they can build their child's resilience, how they can support children's mental health and well-being, identifying some of the risks, but not focusing too much on that. Really, it's about trying to help parents connect with their nearly innate abilities, but their parenting abilities to be aware of their children's emotional well-being and to enhance that. And to also know when to seek help for maybe mental health difficulties that are becoming more serious, that they feel they can't cope with. So this is very much about trying to empower parents. We're very aware, a recent survey that we conducted indicates that 72% of parents worry about their children's mental health. During COVID, we saw, you know, 60% of parents felt their children needed more support with anxiety. So there's a theme continually coming up from research that says, look, parents are under pressure. They're worried about their mental health, about their children's mental health, and we are trying to really support them to find solutions.
Right. There's nothing really new in that, is there? I mean, that's the way it's always been. And to some degree, it's the way it should be, that there's a disconnect between parents and children.
Yeah, I don't think there's a disconnect. I think what happened is that, and it's for lots of different reasons, I think what happened is that, you know, new parents are joining the parenting cohort every day, which is fantastic. And what happened then is they are faced with new and growing challenges. The you know, those experienced parents are also being faced with that, but for them it's a little different because they've been through all of this before, maybe. But ultimately, a natural step back is to go, I'm worried. You know, these are challenges that other parents have never had to deal with. So social media being an example, you know, so you're looking at sort of some of the news footage of things like Gaza, very distressing for our parents, very distressing for children. So all the time we see new challenges, but they're not really new, because parents have the ability, they understand that if you go back to basic parenting skills, you will be able to support, you'll be able to support your children. But it's really important to remind people of that, because there's so many different messages being presented around the massive challenges. And you know, some of the commentary is not helpful. You know, you hear people saying, well, parents can do nothing about this. They don't know what their children are doing on their mobile phones or whatever. Parents can do things about it. Parents build a relationship with their child. They build up the child's resilience, their mental wellness. They build up the communication skills, and that will succeed in protecting and helping young people navigate all these things.
Yeah, well, I suppose what I meant by a disconnect is that parents and children tend to live in different worlds, and that seems to be the natural state of things, as has always been the case. Parents didn't understand when children liked rock and roll, the devil's music.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And that's before we get to punk rock or whatever the case may be. There's things that children do that parents don't understand, and I think that's probably half of the attraction. One of the things now, as you say, is social media. And parents do feel at a loss, but you're saying that they don't have to find themselves in a situation where their children are going down these rabbit holes, like the examples we saw on television last night, that parents can do something proactively before that happens, is it?
Yeah, I mean, you make a very good point. No child wants their parent to be their pal, their friend. A child's world is a child's world, and it's a very important world for the child, and the priorities. I mean, you just have to look at it. There was some very interesting commentary yesterday around two-year-olds and what they can teach parents. But two-year-olds have their own world, and we can't. I as a 60-year-old, can't understand the world of a two-year-old, but I can understand stuff around protection, around mental health, and around, and I have the ability to look into what that two-year-old is doing and learn from the two-year-old. And that's no different from a 15 or 16-year-old. No 15 or 16-year-old wants their parents to be 15 or 16. What they want is their parents to be parents. But the parent has to learn about the world of the 15 and 16-year-old. They might not understand it, but they can certainly learn about it. And there's very few differences in a 15, 16-year-old world, really. There's a lot of different challenges, no doubts, but the core parenting skills apply, the core needs of a 15-year-old apply, and we go back to basic principles. You know, and I know it sounds really simple, but loving your child unconditionally, building their self-esteem, helping them be happy, making sure they're safe as best you can, open communications, they're all key skills that really will protect them and their mental health.
But what if they shut down? And children do shut down. They tend to shut down around those mid-teen years, 15, 16. Yeah, stupid, no, monosyllabic. What do you do then when they won't talk to you?
You keep the door open, number one. You find communicate. If a young person says, yeah, no, maybe, cool, whatever, you're still communicating. You find ways to communicate with teenagers, and parents of teenagers will know this. And they also know that this is a communication style, but ultimately their teenager needs them. So the main thing, and also step back to when you were a teenager and say, well, how did I communicate? Did I want to sit down and have the big discussion about social media risks and my emotional health? No, I did not. I wanted to be out with my mates and all the rest, but I wanted to know that I could have a discussion with my parents if I ran into trouble. And I also wanted to get the information, albeit that I might pretend that I didn't need it. So you go back to remembering your own adolescence, you keep the door open, and you all the time keep communicating at the level that your child chooses to do that, because it changes. Very quickly in leaving cert year 18, 19, young people's communications with their parents change completely again. Mm. And they're much more open, because they're starting to communicate like adults. So it's working through those phases and giving a young person space to communicate at their own level.
Yeah. Your webinar today is aimed at parents or guardians or people looking after children who are in primary school or in secondary school, for that matter. And I suppose a lot of our conversation is hinged on the problems that children may face when they go on social media. And we were talking about that earlier on, and this a minimum age of 13. Somebody texting in to us saying it's not 13, they're starting at 6, 7, 8 years of age. And I suppose that makes a very important point too, does it not, in that this is a job, all these skills that you're talking about, that needs to be applied from the day a child is born.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's you know, risks are there in life. I mean, sorry, let's start with, there's some material on social media that adults shouldn't have access to, not alone children. Very damaging material, and we need to start addressing that, number one. Then secondly is the issue of what children have access to, etc. But there's different people have different responsibilities here. Regulators have responsibility, the service providers have responsibility, but ultimately for a parent, that none of that really matters. What they want to do is make sure that their child is safe, and the way to do that is have open communication as best you can, no matter what age the child is, starting at whatever age. And, you know, whether, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, they're talking about the internet because the internet's a reality. They've seen you on the internet. They know that probably TV is coming in on the internet. And so there's all that stuff going on. So open communication as early as possible in an age appropriate way. You don't want to be telling 6-year-olds about some of the stuff that's concerning a 15-year-old. So you've got to do it in a very age appropriate way.
And it's not just virtual experiences because children can be cruel. That's always been the case. And school can be a nightmare for some children.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, we're right to focus on risks that are presented, like risks of social media. But I mean, all the risks that existed 10, 15, 20 years before the internet are still there. Bullying, just safety from abuse, etc. All of those things are realities in our world, and we have to help make sure that our children are protected from them. Their mental health is key, but also their physical safety is key. And that's a core part of parenting, and that involves taking control when a child is too young to look after themselves, and giving them more and more space through communication and safety mechanisms and all the rest of it. And that's absolutely essential to parenting.
Okay. Paul, people can log on through the St. Patrick's website, is it?
Yes, I think so. stpatricks.ie/events.
Okay, and that's beginning at 11 o'clock this morning. We'll repeat that. You can also look at it, I think, through some of the social media that St. Patrick's has on all of the usual sites. I'm sure there's links to it there as well. Thank you indeed for joining us this morning, Paul. I think there'll be a lot of interest in this webinar starting at 11 o'clock today for parents and guardians. Paul Gilligan is CEO of St. Patrick's Mental Health Services.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Well, now talk about generational change. We've an new Taoiseach who, as you may know, told the British Irish Parliamentary Assembly this week that people of Simon Harris's generation are more familiar with European capitals like Berlin and Paris than they are with Derry and Belfast. This was reported in the Irish Times in a new project that the Irish Times has launched called Common Ground, which is looking at the relationships between stories on this island and in Britain. If you look at Common Ground on the Irish Times now, there is that story about the Taoiseach talking about the different capital cities. There's Barney O'Dowd, who was laid to rest in County Meath, the troubled survivor. Mark Hennessy is writing about Britain and how it shouldn't fear an honest approach to past sins, according to an historian. Story on Sinn Féin being out of touch with its supporters, according to AIM 2, and a story about steak knife, for that matter. These are just some of the stories being reported on in Common Ground, this new project that has been established by the Irish Times. It's headed up by Mark Hennessy, who is the Ireland and Britain editor and former political correspondent, London editor and news editor of the Irish Times. And Mark joins us in studio this morning. A very good morning to you, and thank you for joining us on the programme.
Thank you for having me.
You're en route to an event, and I take it we'll be reading in the Irish Times about tourism in Carlingford.
Well, I hope so. Once I leave here, we'll go there for a few hours and see how we get on. And it's something, this project is one where we're trying to bring all of the strands together. It's not that we're necessarily doing something new, but we hope to do more of what we have been doing. And you do have a situation where if you take the island as a whole, you know, the island is partitioned in more ways than just the border. It's partitioned mentally in every other way. And there, it, Simon's Harris's point yesterday, and you saw the reaction, and there was a lot of very critical reaction on social media from a whole variety of people. Some of it hysterical, you could, one might reasonably argue. The reality is that he's right, whether we like it, want to accept it or not. And maybe not in a place like Louth, because people have a much closer relationship with the border. But the further south you go, the further the border is, both mentally, geographically, and every other way. And if you are talking to younger people in Cork or Limerick, and unless they are politically activated in some shape or form, they will have been in Berlin more often than they will have been in Belfast.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it.
Many of them are there because, as we heard earlier on from the Youth Council, the cost of housing. But there's homeowners in this country who don't remember the troubles.
Well, exactly. And at one level, that gives people an extraordinary level of freedom, because one of the great abilities of the human condition is to forget and to move into a new generation, and people look at things in a different way. But, I mean, I've been at quite a few projects recently dealing with reconciliation, and you're talking to a lot of young people who say they've left the troubles behind. It doesn't matter to them. And yet when you talk to them in more detail, their lives are still defined by it, because they don't go to a particular place, or if they do go to a particular place, they go with a certain radar on, look out for trouble. You have what Claire Hanna and the SDLP calls the sectarian radar, where people in the north can read each other a mile away in a way that perhaps southerners and particularly further south would struggle to
And are happy to pick a fight. I mean, Simon Harris was accused of picking a fight, if you like.
you know, if we're going to... We have a debate facing us over the next 10 or 15 years, and we can have all the opinions that we like on it, and we can either shout and roar at each other to practically no great effect other than negative ones, or we can try and engage and try to understand why the other person thinks in the way that they do. And it doesn't mean we like them, it doesn't mean we agree with them or anything else, but that we try to understand why do they wake up in the morning in the way that they do, and why are they looking at the world, and then try to reach some accommodation in the middle ground that would suit everybody, and that maybe none of us would be entirely happy with, but would all of us could live with. Or because if you look at, I interviewed Dick Spring in December for the anniversary of the 30th anniversary of the Downing Street Declaration. And Dick isn't somebody who comes onto the political pitch anymore, because he's been there, he's done that, he's retired. And he said, why would I want to do this so that people would just shout at me? But nevertheless, he agreed to do it. And one of the points he was making in it was that if you are in the South, that there are large numbers of people in the South whose opinion on the unification of the island in the years to come will be improved if they see a functioning Northern Ireland. There are people in some nationalist areas in Northern Ireland who would argue the opposite, that the more dysfunctional Northern Ireland becomes, the more likely it is that a united Ireland would happen. But the problem with that argument is that it is actually denying agency to people in the South. It's almost like saying that because Northerners want it, therefore Southerners should simply accept it. And that is problematic in ways, because there's a danger if you put that argument to people in the South and you say it's going to cost a lot of money, that there'll be a percentage of people who will say, well, thank you very much, but not madly keen on that.
20 billion a year for 20 years.
Well, exactly. Well, and we can argue about those figures. And in fact, that report kind of feeds into the point I was making earlier, the John Fitzgerald Edgar Morgenrath report. And it put that 20 billion for 20 years as a top end figure. And it was based on a whole set of assumptions with which one could argue greatly. In fact, there's a few bits in it that I would definitely disagree with. I mean, for instance, it's making the argument that there would be no continuing subvention from London in the immediate aftermath of unification, where it's probably more likely that you'd have a reducing scale were that to happen for X number of years. So there's all sorts of things that you can disagree with in that report. But the reaction from people who are coming with a deeply partisan or campaigning attitude is that John Fitzgerald is the son of Gareth, and he's a West Brit, and he's this and he's that and he's the other. He's none of those things, right? He's a very able economist, and one can disagree with an able economist in a reasonable fashion and try and draw some lessons from the point that he makes. And
even though I would disagree with him on figures, at least certainly on the subvention side, the points that the two economists were making about the structure of Northern Ireland and the fact that the North's education system is a mess. It's discriminatory against people coming from poorer backgrounds, and that if you do come from poorer backgrounds, your educational outcomes are woefully behind those coming from a wealthier background, and making the point that for that to change, you need to change it now in the hope of having an effect 10, 15, 20 years from now.
Yeah.
So you need to act now in the hope of change, and you know, going back to our decision to have free second level education in 67.
I'll be looking forward to reading about tourism in Carlingford in the Irish Times, because you're going to this conference today, and I'll be obviously interested in what happens at the conference. But I think in many ways it'll address the biggest challenge that we have on the island on both sides of the border, and that is living together, because that is something that we're going to have to do. And tourism is the easiest example of understanding that, and how that expands into things like the Narrow Water Bridge the Shared Ireland Programme and money for the A5.
And as you say, I mean, you know, the more people cross the border and the more people learn about each other, one would hope the better. Obviously, by the nature of the beast you travel anywhere, there's always the possibility of a negative outcome. But the vast majority of... there used to be a joke in Cork when I was growing up that height of the troubles, 75% of people had never been across the border, and 75% of those who had never wanted to go back. And like every joke, there was a germ of truth in it. And, you know, people can going back to the Harris comments, people can throw all sorts of abuse afterwards, but it doesn't deny the reality that we don't know enough about each other. And in some ways, it is striking that the further south you go, the people they know least about are Northern Nationalists. You know, they've actually some understanding of where unionism is coming from, even if they they can bag them and tag them and dislike them and whatever, but they kind of know where they're coming from. They're less clear.
We've met many of them here in Oldbridge.
Exactly.
There was a joke when I was growing up about a competition, and first prize was a week in Belfast. Second prize was two weeks in Belfast.
Yeah, but you know, anybody.
But now everybody's happy to go to Belfast.
Exactly,
it's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific city and very vibrant, and I'm up and down all the time, and more people will go. But you know, I was saying this at a conference recently, and Tanya Bonatti was mildly critical of what I was saying. But if you look at the M1 traffic, and you see a huge number of Southern Reg cars going north and a huge number of Northern Reg cars coming south. If you subtract the Dublin Airport bound element of the Northern Reg, and if you subtract the IKEA traffic, what's left? And if you look at traffic along the border, 5 or 10 miles, you'll see all sorts of cross-fertilisation going on. Once you go to 20 miles, once you go to 30 miles, it starts weakening very, very considerably. Go to Belfast and look for Southern Reg cars. Yeah. You know, you'll count them and you'll come across them, but they will be
few
one
and far between.
They're few and far between. And that kind of does show that there's a huge amount of work that we have to get clear in our own head about what the future may hold. And the future may hold a referendum. It may not.
Yeah.
We're not coming to this project with a sense that it will or will not happen, but we are absolutely convinced that this debate about the constitutional future of the island is going to become a more profound element of debate in society in the years to come. And it can be destabilising and dangerous if it's handled badly, and it can be destabilising and dangerous even if it never happens if it's handled badly. So we have, and it can be hugely positive if it's done in the other way. So we need to trying to come at this in a way where we're attempting to understand the opinions of people who we don't understand and in often cases we don't like.
Okay, it's the Irish Times Common Ground Project. What's the objective? The Irish Times, known as the paper of record, is it to record this new phase?
I mean, you know, this is in some ways is the kind of thing that only people who want to create a stick to beat themselves with would actually embark on. But it has four pillars to it in terms of the north-south coverage, east-west issues between Belfast, London, Dublin, London, issues in Britain that could impact on us, Scottish independence, English devolution, all that kind of thing. We've seen in the last 10 years what that the opinion of somebody in Southampton does matter to us, because they do have the ability to make a mess of our lives without thinking about us. And then there is the role of the diaspora, and that's going to become a huge issue in the years to come, years ahead of whether a referendum happens or not, because you're going to have all sorts of rows about who gets the right to vote. And if I left Ireland in the 1940s, do I hold on to retain the right? Or if I'm a grandfathered passport holder, where am I right? How do you tell the difference between one form of Irish passport or another? This is going to keep lawyers very busy in the years to come. And we can approach this in a way whereby we are all coming to it with flags and saying, on this hill I stand, and all the rest of it, and then we can wait for the inevitable trouble. Or we can come at it in a way whereby we are trying to understand each other, and our job in all of this is to put as much information in front of people so that they can go away and make a clear and rational judgment and decide whatever it is what they want to decide. We're not telling them what to decide.
Well, your instincts politically, I think, are very highly regarded. And one final question for you, Mark Hennessy. Do you believe that under the Common Ground Project that in time you'll be reporting on a border poll?
I don't think. I think there's a very strong campaign being put behind setting 2030 as a date. And I think that has been quite successful in getting that date into the ether. And once you create a date, you create a target. And once you create a target, it builds up an inherent momentum. Do I think we're even remotely ready for a debate 6 years from now, for a vote 6 years from now? We're not, as of today. So if we are going to be going down that kind of a road, I think we need to hurry up, because otherwise we're going to land ourselves in a lot of trouble. I would think if it happens, it'll happen after 2030 and probably a significant portion thereafter. But who can tell?
Okay. Very interesting. I think the reports will be very interesting for everybody listening to us this morning as well. And thanks for coming in to us en route to Carlingford.
Thank you for having me.
Forward to hearing and reading about Carlingford and the tourism potential in the Irish Times. Great to see you as well. Mark Hennessy, who is heading up the Irish Times project Common Ground.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Well, the group of unions representing workers at Tara Mines and Bulleiden were at the Workplace Relations Commission this week. In the early hours of this morning, there was an agreement that was reached at the WRC. We're joined by John Regan, SIPTU Divisional Organiser in Meath. A very good morning to you, John. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. I think it was after 2 o'clock in the morning when you finished up last night. But there's an agreement that you'll be putting to a ballot of your members.
Good morning, Michael, and your listeners. Yeah, that's the you're 100% right. It was 2 o'clock this morning when we finally, concluded the talks. And all that has to happen now is the final text of the document has to be worked on with the WRC, and that is expected to happen today or tomorrow. It's an opportunity now for the workers after 9 months of layoff to make a decision on whether this deal is good enough to go back into the mine. It's been a different set of negotiations and talks and a difficult agenda to be trying to deal with. But as you say, we now have an opportunity, and there is a set of proposals that will be presented to the workers next week. Full group of unions will meet on Thursday of next week. We don't have a venue at the moment, but hopefully we'll conclude that today. And we will go to ballot from that day and have a result on the 3rd of May.
Okay. So you'll be balloting over the period of a couple of weeks. The details, though, to be given to workers next Thursday, is it?
We meet with the section and the wider group of shop stewards on Tuesday evening. They will be brought through the document first, and then we will bring all the members on the Thursday through the same document, and people will be given the option to ballot directly after the general meeting. But the ballot will be open for a number of days of next week. The count will be right. Well, the ballot will be open until the 3rd of May.
And in the days after that, the count. The agreement that you've reached with the company is supported by the workers, if they vote in favour of it, how long will it take before the mine can reopen?
Well, we have, without, again, Michael, I'm sure, and your listeners will appreciate, we need to talk to the members and not, you know, get into any great detail in the media. They need to hear it straight from us. But there is an understanding written into it that the return to work will be expedited very quickly. And that's what we insisted on having. And we insisted on having it. Groups of people will come back, or crews. So that's all written into it. So we hope that will be, you know, put in, as we've always said, there's a phasing to happen. It can't just open immediately. And as I say, it'll be speedily done.
Okay.
And the company have committed to that as well.
Will there be a job for everyone?
Unfortunately not. And again, throughout the whole process, the mine has reduced its targets. And by reducing targets, you reduce manpower. And there will be redundancies. They will all be voluntary redundancies. It is in the document that there'll be no compulsory redundancies. So people will be free to make their own mind up whether this job is for them going forward. And others will be obviously, you know, not interested in the voluntary redundancy and getting back into employment. So, there is redundancy terms agreed now.
How many redundancies, sir, can you tell us at this stage? The company seeking 200, had they?
Yeah, the company is, you know, again, in control of who will they will let go, because of that's the nature of a voluntary redundancy package. Skills and everything else has to be assessed. They are looking for 200, but there's already 40-plus gone under an early retirement package. That was floated when the mine went into care and maintenance. So we're looking at somewhere around 160, 150 to 160 possible redundancies.
Okay, but that would bring the overall workforce down to about 450. And I gather that there will be some people who would like to avail of a redundancy package, but it won't be open to them based on what you said there. It depends on whether it suits the skill sets that the company wants to keep on.
Yeah, well, look, that's the way voluntary redundancy packages have always worked. The company is in, you know, control of who can go, and that, you know, we can't do a lot about that. That's the nature of a voluntary system.
Yeah, no, I understand. But at the same time, we're talking about a package that has been agreed with the unions, because this has been very contentious up to now, that the company had unilaterally made an offer to the workers. That has changed. And you say in your letter to the members that the package that was on offer has been enhanced.
Yes, absolutely. And the company, in floating their original package, also identified that they would be negotiating an enhanced package, and we've secured that.
Okay. Has there been discussion on what happens if an additional 160 people don't volunteer for redundancy? You say that there won't be mandatory redundancies, but undoubtedly the company will want those redundancies one way or another.
Well, again, it hasn't actually been debated, because we are in the unknown area, like you would be in any employment with a voluntary situation. People have to volunteer first, and then the company has to weigh up the skill sets and decide whether they meet the target that they want to meet. As natural, you know, normal industrial relations, if they don't get the correct and don't get the numbers, then they will have to sit down with us again and we'll have to work on a way forward.
Okay. And I take it that there may be Tara Mines workers feeling a little bit frustrated or anxious now, looking for more detail. You don't want to do that on the airwaves, as you've said. You'll make it known to them directly as a trade union speaking to its members next Thursday. But would you say to those workers listening to us this morning that the future for them is somewhat brighter today than it was over the course of the last 9 months?
Well, of course it is. We have a set of proposals that now gives them the opportunity to bring this so-called temporary layoff to a conclusion, but that's for them to decide. We're not going to make any pressure and put any further pressure on people. They will make their own mind up whether this is a good enough a deal. It brings the uncertainty of no employment, and we're also just on the cliff edge of social welfare coming to an end, and job seekers allowance and means testing has been ongoing, and there will be people even hit more, are facing more hardship depending on how that evaluation is done on people.
Okay, well, good news. And far better news than was the situation up to 2 o'clock in the morning last night when you finally came to this agreement. I'm sure the workers will be very anxious for the detail, which, as you say, will be forthcoming next week. And then the vote will take place, and all going well, workers should be returning to Tara Mines over the summer months, I gather.
Yeah, it's going to take a number of months to bring people in and have everybody back in full employment. But again, I think the company have written out to everybody, and they are advocating that a full return to the mine is going to be prioritised by them. So, we hope they do that and deliver if there is an agreement at the end of the next on the 3rd of May.
Very good. John, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Much appreciated as always. John Regan, SIPTU Divisional Organiser in Meath.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Yesterday, Simon Harris took leaders' questions for the first time in the Dáil, and was reminded about the time when he was the Minister for Health, and that in 2017 he made promises to children with scoliosis and their parents, promises that were not fulfilled.
Taoiseach, in 2017 you promised that by the end of that year no child would wait longer than 4 months for scoliosis surgery. That was 7 years ago, and that promise has been broken again and again. And just so as we are clear, the four-month target was agreed between you as Minister for Health and the HSE based on international best practice. That promise you made was broken. You failed to build the capacity needed here. And in 2019, you ended the scheme through which children could travel abroad to have their operations faster.
That's Mary Lou MacDonald, the Sinn Féin president, told the Taoiseach that now it's actually too late for some because they've been left waiting too long.
I spoke with one mother last night whose child is now no longer a child. They're now 19 and they're inoperable. Why are they inoperable? They are inoperable because they waited and they waited and they waited. And she said directly, they've followed all the right protocols, all of the care paths, and for what? And words and rhetoric are of no value to them. The only good faith, actually, that matters on this subject is the good faith of government. That's the issue. The issue here is that we have, 4,000 children awaiting their first consultation. That's the length of the list. We have 270 children on the surgery waiting list, 78 of whom have waited and waited far longer than 4 months. And here's perhaps the worst feature of all. The most complex, the most desperate of cases, in many cases, have the longest wait. Yeah. And they are now officially, these families, these children, these young adults, these parents are in a state of absolute panic.
Let's hear some of the Taoiseach's response.
When I was Minister for Health, you are absolutely correct that I did place a real focus on this issue. And it was said to me by the then Director General of the HSE that they would put a plan in place to make sure that no child waited longer than 4 months. And that plan originated, as you correctly say, from clinical advice, and I believe similar clinical advice exists within the NHS. That was the clinical advice then, and it is the clinical advice now. Of course, there can, from time to time, be complexities, as all of us know, in relation to individual cases and multiple medical conditions and how they interact. But having said that, that's where the 4 months came from. What I definitely know is by placing that focus on scoliosis, we saw a very, very, very significant reduction in the number of children waiting over 4 months. And I think if we're going to start this leader's questions engaging in good faith, I think you'll acknowledge that when you look at the figures, that after I gave that commitment, the progress that was made in a short period of time in very significantly reducing the number of children waiting over 4 months, it was real, was felt, there were weekly reports produced. The COVID pandemic happened, waiting times worsened, and waiting times worsened for all procedures, including scoliosis.
An unapologetic Taoiseach, Simon Harris, responding to Mary Lou MacDonald. Now, thanks to Margaret, who's texting the programme today, quoting Senator Aaron McGrehan, saying the internet is a cesspit. And she says the primetime programme proved it last night. How can parents hand a smartphone to their child? Would they hand them a gun? Phones are used as babysitters. Hand it to them, it'll keep them quiet. Should it be regarded as child abuse? It's way past time, she says, so the government tell these internet companies to account for the vile, evil content that's being allowed on their sites. Are they afraid? Or is the money they get from these companies more important than the health and well-being of the people? As usual, in Ireland, everything is reactive instead of proactive. The horse has always bolted and long gone before anything is done to rectify a problem. Will our government be the first to drain the cesspit? I won't hold my breath, says Margaret. By the way, my phone is a little Nokia. It costs €39. I can ring and receive calls and send and receive texts, no internet, believe it or not, my life is still functioning without it. Thank you, Margaret, for telling us all about that. Now, as you know, the report into how legislation governing abortion in this country and the many recommendations made by its chair, Mary O'Shea, has been with the government for some 12 months now.
Your own government has been sitting on the expert report which pointed out these problems for 12 months now. Instead of action, we've had a game of political pass the parcel. The expert report kicked to the Health Committee before being kicked back to the government, where it has been since December.
This is the leader of the Social Democrats, Holly Cairns, who had three specific questions yesterday for the Taoiseach, Simon Harris.
In your reply, can you please specifically answer these three questions? Will you remove the mandatory three-day waiting period? End the criminalisation of healthcare workers and provide more clarity when it comes to providing abortion in cases of fetal abnormalities.
Right, now they're the three questions about the recommendations made to government, but yesterday the Taoiseach could not answer any of those three questions.
You're right that we did commission an independent review. We have received that independent review. The Oireachtas Health Committee considered it. It was sent back to the Department of Health, to the Minister for Health in December. The bulk of the recommendations, as you acknowledge and also acknowledge are important, are in the operational space. They've largely been put in place and are being embedded across the health service. And then there are some recommendations that aren't in the operational space that are in the legislative space. And yes, they do fall to these houses to decide how to act. In relation to the three specific questions, these are issues that the government has not yet considered. But the Minister for Health will engage at the Cabinet Committee on Health on this shortly.
Simon Harris went further than to say the government has had the report and its recommendations for over a year, or that it has not acted on that report as yet, because the Taoiseach called into question whether this government will ever even consider the recommendations that has been made to it.
I also am struck, as the Health Minister, as you rightly say, I also do think in politics your word does matter. And I do think when you publish draft legislation, indeed, It does matter because when you publish draft legislation alongside a referendum and you say, if you vote yes, here's the law, that does also have to count for something.
That was not the answer that Holly Cairns had wanted to hear.
Taoiseach, to hear that after a year after the report was given to government that it hasn't been considered is extremely worrying. I heard the Health Minister yesterday say that we had to be cognizant of what people voted for and repeal as well, and in any plan to reform the law, and you referenced it there too. So I don't know if you're suggesting that you think the majority of people who voted for repeal wanted to continue to force women who need terminations for medical reasons to travel abroad. Because I have to say that I think the women, the very brave women who spoke out about needing a termination for medical reasons during the repeal referendum, won more hearts and minds and yes votes than your heads of bill. But for argument's sake, say that it is about the heads of bill, and you want to kind of honour that. In the heads of bill, it committed to having a review to see if there were any serious issues with the current legislation, and some very, very serious issues have arisen. The fact that people are still being forced abroad, the fact that women are being forced to wait 3 days to access medical care, something we don't see in any other kind of provision or care. It has no place in our law or in modern medicine, and it needs to go.
Holly Cairns. Now, some comments before we leave you. One from a listener who says all politicians spend that much time looking in their rear view mirror, making speeches about the failures of each other. Where's the plan to move forward? None. They're all the same. And the same caller says Simon Harris was a minister, not a surgeon. He can only try. Well, he made promises, I suppose, is the point. And if you make a promise or a commitment, people will remind you of that if you don't fulfill it. And I would have thought that that was only natural in politics. Tom, in touch with us, saying, why are children in their own homes? One thing to think about, children in care and foster care, that's very hard to deal with. He also says, I beg your pardon, it's Betty who says that children can buy, oh, it's Pat who says children can get a council house for €10 a week. Sorry, Pat. Pat in County Meath, thank you for your message. That's our programme for today. God willing, we'll see you for our next programme tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.